Let's begin then. Let us bring our palms together to make our heart full to veneration to the Supremely Enlightened One, the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one. Let us remind ourselves that as we make this mark of respect and extend our veneration, this is not a mere token of our obeisance, but this is a solemn pledge that we make and take upon ourselves, a pledge of our allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, which represent the truth, the path to that truth and the practice to get us there. Once we do that, let us take a moment to observe the precepts, reminding ourselves that the precepts shall be our guide to keep us virtuous and steadfast on the path to Nibbana. Let us then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and witness this wonderful meritorious deed and to rejoice in the devotion and the commitment that each and every one of you have made towards your deliverance. May they rejoice in that merit. May they also be able to listen to the teaching of the Great Master and understand the Four Noble Truths and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So with all that in mind, let us make a start to today's proceedings by chanting the Namaskar. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. There's a reason why I explained to you the significance of making this devaradhana. Why we invite the devas, the brahmas. Some people consider that they are somehow either subordinate to the devas or that they are beneath the devas and the devas are superior to them in every possible way. They're above, they're superior. And then we have to go and beg at the devas' feet. Devas being gods, deities, all of them. This is a very traditional way of thinking. You can't fault it entirely because it is a very prevalent way of thinking. And for people who don't understand how to become someone of a character that appeals to the gods, to the deities, to the heavens, then the only way that exists is to be subservient to them and to beg from them if you need something, to try and please the gods somehow, to get something from them and to get them to do something for you. This is why you see traditionally people go to the devala and they make offerings, very mundane things generally, such as fruits, sometimes money. I mean, you've got to wonder, right? Like, if these are the things that gods use in the heavens, do they also use rupees and cents? Sterling pounds and the Australian or the American dollars, is that what they use up there? And then usually in some devalayas, it depends, you know, the Kapu Mahatya service depends on the amount that you... I mean, so gods have this kind of... I mean, I don't know, to me that doesn't seem very godly. That seems very Godzilla. How can a god discriminate like that? Those who have money, those who have the means, they serve well. So then it's like, I mean, what is that deal that we have with gods? It's kind of like bribing them. But gods aren't like that. You know, gods were people who lived among you. They were like us at one point. When you associate with some people, don't you feel like, you know, these, they really have some very godly characteristics. They're very divine in their nature. They make it their life's purpose to give as much as they can, to help others in need, to support people, to go out of their way to help and support others whenever there is a need for it. Do you not know people like that? I'm sure you are one of them in your social circles. And there will be plenty of other people that you have seen like that. You know, these are the people who are very willing to give, sacrifice themselves. Deva is that. Deva is to... Deva, Denna, is to give. This giving nature, this charitable nature, this the generosity in one's character, these are the seeds that pave the path to divinity. So if... Now, think of a human being of that nature. Forget the devas for a second. Someone you know who is always very generous. Right? Whatever they have, they are more than willing to give. Sometimes they will go out of their way to give things if it helps to better someone else's life. Can you bribe them with things? Like, can you go and give them some money and say, like, can you take my money and do this for me? Typically what they'll say is, you keep your money, I don't want your money. I will do it for you anyway, because you need it, I will do it for you. I don't want your money. Like the Vedamahatyas in the olden days. They didn't take money for their service. This is all they wanted. This is all you could offer them. A sheaf of betel leaves, that's it. Because that was the tradition. This was symbolic. Not that they need bulat. This was symbolic of well-being, of good health, of ashirvad. It was a blessing that was made, that was exchanged between the two parties. This was a symbol of abundance. Bulat. A symbol of abundance. So when you exchanged a hand of betel leaves, what you were offering was abundance. May you have in abundance. May there be prosperity, was the wish that was made. You know, that is what people worked on the basis of. It was not money. It was minds that exchanged things. Service for blessings. Blessings was mean nothing more than the goodness that sprung in one's heart. See, it didn't matter to whom it was given. As long as it was given to the universe, people understood this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'm throwing you bits and pieces. Let me try and stitch this all together so it makes sense. It's making sense in my mind, but that's no use to you. Now, I have to try and put this out in words. Let's see how good a task I can do with that. So, here's how it worked. Do you remember last week or the week before I said, treat everything with due respect? Yeah? Okay, good. The basis for treating everything with due respect is that we are all one in nature. Okay? We are all one in nature. We are all made of the same stuff. Therefore, this sense of separation that we have is merely a sense of separation. It does not exist in reality. This uniqueness that we feel is only a perception that we have. Now, because people back in the day, they associated with people of insight, the sages, the wise, the Mahasangha. They knew about this truth. They realized soon after they came of age and they began to understand the world and the way it works, parents were very diligent about getting their children on the path. Because parents knew back then why we are born as human beings. It's not to become doctors or lawyers or engineers, but these are things that we have to do to sustain ourselves while we are alive. But the purpose, the be-all and end-all of life was not that. The be-all and end-all of life was to get out of this journey of samsara So everything else was a means to that end. What I mean by that, ladies and gentlemen, is back then, when someone took up the profession of a teacher, a doctor, an engineer, I don't know whether they had lawyers back then, but let's assume that they did. Whatever that profession was, a farmer, these were very commonplace. People took those roles up, they took that up as a career, not because they wanted to make a career out of it. It was merely a way for them to earn sufficient merits to progress on their path. Because they realized that to get anywhere in life, we must serve. Through service, they realized we earn merits. So they didn't see that being a teacher was a way to make money. That's not what came to their mind. In fact, back if you go back many, many decades, money was not even part of the conversation. Today, the teaching profession has been undervalued so much that teaching is done in exchange for money. That's what teaching has come to today. Once again, I'm not suggesting we change anything. That's not what I'm suggesting here. You know that, right? I always tell you this. I'm not here to change the world. I'm only here to help you understand the world and then make your own personal choices. The medical profession was not done for money. Money was not even considered. It wasn't anywhere in one's world. It was not part of the conversation. There were those who were very skilled at that. And they realized that these are gifts given to us by the universe to serve. Every man is born with some talent or the other. Some can sing, some can dance, some can write, some can heal, some can cultivate, some can teach. You know what your skills are. Maybe you only know a little part of what your skills and talents are. Perhaps much of it you are yet to realize. Although you've lived for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, maybe you still haven't figured out all your skills, talents and what you're good at, because the opportunity has never struck. Therefore, maybe there are plenty of talents that still lay hidden. But here's what people saw these talents and skills as back then. This was maybe in the time of our grandparents, grandparents, grandparents. Perhaps we are going back now 30, 40 decades, maybe even before that. Perhaps maybe even 50 decades ago. There was a time when money was never part of the picture, was never part of the conversation. Every human being that was born, who had this exposure, who had by sheer power of merits, learned that human life was an opportunity for them to maximize their potential for service and therefore to earn merits, which was going to be the currency on their way to Nibbana. Nibbana was merely freedom from all suffering. They realized that that was what they were born as human beings for. So they wanted to get themselves there as well as help as many others as possible along the way. So then they figured, what do I have that can help, that I can use to help others on the way to their salvation? This is a question they ask themselves. What skills, talents do I have that I can use to help others along the way to Nibbana? Because when you help someone else, you're indirectly helping yourself. See, this was the transaction, not money. This transaction could not be valued with money because it was priceless. They were giving Nibbana and paving the path to Nibbana for each other. Therefore, there was the farmer and then there was the village doctor. So, what did they do for each other? When the farmer cultivated his crop, regardless of whether he used the doctor's services or not, he would go and give the doctor his portion. That was not on demand. That was not remuneration. It was merely an opportunity for him because he realized that I have been gifted with the skill to farm. So if the universe has given me this skill to farm, then I shall use my skills to serve. So what did he do? When his crop, when it was time for him to yield his crop, he got his crop and he gave some to the farmer. So he gave some to the doctor, to the village doctor. He gave some to the village physician. He gave some to the teacher. There was a teacher there. The first and foremost part he offered to the Mahasangha, of course. So that's where they started. The first and foremost part was offered to the Mahasangha. It was not in exchange necessarily for anything. It was just because I have the power to serve. I have the gift of service. Therefore, I shall serve. So I started talking about why we invite the devas. Now we are going, we are miles away from that. Hopefully we'll work our way back. This is what happens when I don't come prepared for my speeches. This is not a prepared speech. So I don't know what's going to come out next. Therefore, when things start coming up in my mind, I now work it out. This is a very impromptu conversation that we are having. So please forgive me if sometimes things feel very disconnected. But give it another 2 hours, things will start settling in. Okay? But you have to be patient and remain attentive, so that you can always piece the part that was said at the beginning with the part that is said at the end. If you forget what I was talking at the beginning, or if you fell asleep somewhere in the middle of the conversation, then the middle part will be missing, so you won't be able to bridge the two things together. Merit and paying attention. These two things are essential for this to work. I'm paying attention to this talk. Hopefully you are as well. So, what did the village farmer do? He yielded his crop. And it didn't matter whether he used the services of the village physician or not, the village teacher, the village astrologer. It didn't matter to him. The village potter. There were people who, essentially, these were not things that people did for a living. But, you know, when we say we do something for a living, it means, it kind of has this meaning that it is what we do to earn money and become successful. But that's the wrong idea. Living was something that was done as a means to the end of Nibbana. Therefore, people lived, yes, just like you and I do today. They lived, but with a very different purpose. They lived so that they could attain Nibbana at the end. That was their only ambition. I'm not going to say for 100%, not every one of them, but the majority were like that. Because they had association with the Mahasangha. I'm talking about your culture, ladies and gentlemen, your tradition. This is your heritage. So please allow me to remind you what your heritage is. This is what your ancestors did. So when you go to the museum, you will see the artifacts that were used back in the day, but perhaps the purpose of it is not there in the museum. And let's try and make sure that the purpose doesn't go to the museum. The purpose should be alive amongst us. It should live long in our hearts and our minds. That should be our ecosystem, the purpose. When a man forgets why he was born, he will use his life for meaningless things. There are many meaningless enterprises, endeavors that a man can use his life for. I'll give you a few examples because I have tried many of them myself. One, earning money. I'm not saying earning money is bad. I'm saying if you commit your life to that, then you have forgotten the reason you were born. So becoming wealthy cannot be someone's purpose in life. It's the wrong purpose. Number two, educating oneself. Another endeavor that I was on. I wanted to educate myself to the nth degree, to the pinnacle of education. Wrong purpose. Once again, I'm not suggesting that education is bad. Education is good, but when it becomes the be-all and end-all of it, that's when you have lost the purpose of education. That's not what education should be there for. Number three, making friends. Having a family. Going places, knowing people. Association. Again, if you do it for the purpose of that, you have lost the purpose of why you were born. You see some people, they have lots of friends. A lot of people they associate with. They thrive on their connections. They always boast about how many friends they know, how many they have on their friends, on their friend list, how many friends they have on their Facebook, and so on. That becomes the be-all and end-all of their life. It's a wrong purpose. It's good to have friends, provided you know what your purpose is. If you know what your purpose is, then you will be very careful about who you choose as your friends, because then you will only associate yourself with noble friends. A noble friend doesn't always have to be someone in a robe. And not everyone in a robe is a noble friend either. So both these statements are valid. A noble friend is someone who helps you live out the purpose of your life. In that way, they are noble. But do you see that when we forget, or when we are not taught by our parents or our elders, our adults, our teachers, whoever, the purpose of our having been born, then we just live, not knowing why we live. Have you ever wondered why you live? Often we ask this question, how do we live? But we hardly ask the question, why do we live? Some people live because they can't die. It's illegal to commit suicide. Therefore they live, because if an attempted suicide is a failure, then they'll have to end up in prison or somewhere. Many people are far more interested in how they live than why they live. Ask yourself, how much of your time and energy have you invested in figuring out how you live? So the how you live involves where you live, the house you live in, the car you drive, your fashion, the people you live with, what you eat. This is all how you live. The places you go, your travel, the country you live in. This is all to do with how you live. Your lifestyle, that's one word for it. The how you live is your lifestyle. This is, in my opinion, overrated. I'm happy to change my lifestyle, provided why I live does not change and remains constant. So the moment I realize that my lifestyle is not conducive to why I live, I will change my lifestyle. That is how I became a monk. My lifestyle changed. I decided to let go of my lay life. I renunciated. Because I was not willing to lose my why I live again. I hadn't known it in the past, but then one day I figured why I live. And so keeping that a constant, the why I live, the how I live started to change. In a nutshell, this has to be the main difference between the life of a monk who comes into the sasana aware of why he lives, and a lay individual. A lay individual, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about the lay attitude. Okay? A lay individual is far more focused and interested in how they live. Whereas someone who chooses to become a monk, or at least adopts a monk's attitude, is far more interested in what? Why they live. They have discovered the purpose of their existence. The other day I told you this to you. Anyone can give life, but hardly anyone can give you a reason to live. Animals can give life. If you have a cat at home, sooner or later, she's going to have a litter. If you have a dog at home, sooner or later, they're going to have pups. So even animals can give life. But can either of them give a reason to their offspring? Have you ever seen a mother cat talking to a little cat and say, "Here, do you know that the reason of your life is to attain happiness?" Have you ever seen a mother dog teach its pups the reason of its existence? See, animals can do that, they can give life. But you are a very special kind of animal. Your superiority is determined by that, whether you have the capacity, the capability to realize the purpose of your life. This is how the universe decides where to position you in this whole thing. Those who don't have the ability to figure out the purpose of their life, they put them into very lowly forms. But those who have the capacity to figure out why they live, the purpose of their lives, they elevate them. That's what the universe does. The fact that you are born in a Sugati means you have the capacity to figure out why you live, the purpose of your life. Now, go back to the village 50 decades ago, 60 decades ago, let's say a century ago. Back in those days, people knew this stuff, at least to a little extent. To a little degree, they knew this stuff. The further back you go, the more they knew this kind of stuff. But then globalization happened, westernization happened, thisization, thatization, commercialization happened, right? And all these isations happened. And in the end, people forgot the purpose of their lives. Now what happens is people are born, right? Every day, I think by the hundreds, people are born. And they just live, not knowing why. They live until they die. Let's be honest, isn't that what most of us have been doing? You are born, you read, you know, one day, soon really, yeah, I'm born. It was not your plan to be born, you were just born, you just realized that you were born someday when you just got to know that, you know, start to make sense of the fact that you are a human being, right? And then from that day on, you realize that one day you're going to die. And you say, thankfully, one day you're going to die, because otherwise you're going to have to keep doing this every day. So then, until the day I die, you try and figure out how to get through life. When you don't realize the purpose of your life, people try to get through life, not get from life. There's a distinction between these two things. Most people try to get through the day. I want you to try to get from the day. Getting through the day, cats and dogs can do. Getting something from the day, that is a very Sugati thing to do. Get something from the day. The day is there to give you stuff. The day is here to teach you lessons. The day is here to help you become wiser. But you have to be ready to take from the day. Anyway, going back to the village once again. So about a century ago, people knew this stuff. Because people knew this stuff, they were not interested in hoarding. They were not interested in planning for the next 100 years. Because they knew that the way to get is to give. Now think about that for a second. If you knew, ladies and gentlemen, that to get anything, all you have to do is give, you wouldn't have to be worried about your tomorrow, would you? Think carefully about what I've just explained to you. Let me put it in other words. If you knew how to dig a well, right, you wouldn't have to be worried about going somewhere where there's no water. Let me give you another example. If you knew how to pray to the rain gods in such a way that they always listen to you, then you wouldn't need to worry about going into the desert. Because you have the skill, right? So if you have that knowledge, then whenever you need water, what would you need to do? Just pray to the rain gods, can I have some water please? And it starts raining. Just imagine that. Now mothers, fathers in the house, when you have to send your children out, say for education, to a hostel or maybe to another country, what are some of the things that you're worried about? Number one, will they starve themselves? Because you haven't taught them how to cook. So will they always have to do takeaways? Right? And you know that's not healthy. So, you're worried then. But if you can teach someone, or you're not worried about it yourself because you know how to cook. I'm assuming you all know how to cook. Where's the Pindapati coming from? So if you know how to cook, you don't need to be worried about starvation, because whatever there is, you will somehow find a way to cook it. If you know someone who knows their herbs well, who know the plants well, right? Then you wouldn't have to be worried about going into the forest or getting lost there to find something to eat, because they will be able to tell you that this is poisonous. You must not be eating this stuff. But this is good. This is healthy. This is all right. So when you have someone who knows their stuff, who knows what they're doing, you need not be worried. Right? In the same manner, back those days, people knew how the universe worked. They knew that to get, all you have to do is give. And the quantity didn't matter. They knew that as well. They knew that the quantity didn't matter. Intention mattered. Therefore, there was no one who was poor enough to have nothing to give. Oh, I love this sermon. There was no one who was so poor they had nothing to give. Why do I say that? Because it was not the quantity, and they knew that. Everyone back then was rich enough that they always had something to give. Because that something, it didn't matter what the quantity was. It didn't have to be a sack full of rice. A handful was just as good. They knew this stuff. They knew that intention was karma. When did you learn that intention was karma? I will take myself as an example. I learned intention was karma, I think, when I was maybe, I mean, I actually truly understood what it meant, intention was karma, I think I was in my 20s. I'd already lived more than a fifth of my life. By the time I figured that intention was karma. But back then, a child who was only 6 years of age, they learned that intention was karma. Therefore, they didn't worry and fear about tomorrow. Tomorrow was never a problem, because if you needed something tomorrow, all you had to do was what? Give. Give how much? How much? It didn't matter. It didn't matter at all. I remember my grandparents telling me stories of how when they were young, in their playtime, now in my generation, what they do for play is take these toy guns and stuff and go around shooting people, or to play computer games, right? There's no giving there. My grandparents used to tell me that when they were young, the things that they used to do for play, so they would build these like stupas at home in their garden. Stupas. Just with mud and clay or something they could get their hands on. And so the siblings, friends, they would get together and do that sort of thing. And then they would make it, and then they would do their offerings to that. What did they offer? Pebbles. That was pirikara. Flowers that they would just pluck from the tree. So the pebbles used to be the dhane. There was no one to eat it, and no one could eat it for that matter, but it didn't matter. Here's a six-year-old offering little rocks. What was it? Dhane. But they'd already started giving. Because the intention was there, no less. So when they grew up, of course, they took the dhana to the temple. Now that was edible food, but when they were younger, it was not edible, it was just rocks, pebbles and stuff. But the amount of merit they earned was about the same. Because back then, the intention was the same. They were offering something to the virtue of the Mahasangha. I tell you folks, you must equip yourself with this knowledge. These are the truly precious lessons for life. I guarantee you will not learn this in your science books. This will not be in your physics books or your chemistry books. This is not going to be in your math lessons. Newton will not teach you this stuff. Einstein will not teach you this stuff. You will only learn this from the lineage of the Buddha, the Sihela Parampara. This has to come in that tradition, but this is your heritage. You are all Sihelayas. Dare I say were? Are we now just a bunch of Sinhalayas? Sinhalaya is a nationality. Sihelaya was an attitude. We are Sinhalese. That's our race. Nationality, if you want to go that far. Sri Lankan. But what does the Sri part mean? Why aren't we just Lankan? Where did the Sri come from? Sri means great. What is it? What is great about us? If we are so great, how come we keep importing everything from every other country in the world? If you want to say something's good, you say it's made in Japan. You look at a car and say, that's a good car, it's made in Germany. So what's great about us then? Then that should be Sri Japan and Sri Germany, right? Why Sri Lanka? As far as I know, there's no other country that has that part in front of their name. What is it that makes you Sri? Sri Mat. What makes you Sri? Think about this, this is your heritage. This is the association. This is the knowledge, this is the wisdom I'm talking about. Your wisdom is what elevates you. The truth. Those who understand the truth, they are superior. Superior in the truth. Superior in their understanding. That's why they call God Almighty. Sri. Our lineage was such. I'm not talking about a blood connection here. It's not that. You cannot become great by blood. It's not that. Just because your father was great doesn't mean you are great. Najaccha vasalo hoti, najaccha hoti brahmano. Kamana vasalo hoti, kamana hoti brahmano. It is not by birth one is great or one is a vasala. It is by action. So what is it that influences action? Wisdom. Knowledge. The truth. See, people had this wisdom back then. Because they associated with those who had wisdom. And therefore, they didn't care about how much was there in the bank account. They didn't even have bank accounts. Today, is it not considered a very respectable, a very honored, a very looked up to thing in society if you see someone who's wealthy? Isn't wealth really a big part of one's, shall we say, status? Yes. Isn't their wealth a huge part of their status? But if you went back a few decades, like I said earlier, people weren't wealthy. Because there was nothing based on which you could count wealth. There was no money to evaluate or to estimate how wealthy they were. Because wealth was not something that was considered in the amount of money they had. Back then, wealth was wisdom. Today, wealth is money. Property. That was not what wealth was. Those days, people didn't have lots and lots and lots of property for themselves. There was property for everyone. That's what people had back then. They just wanted somewhere to live because they realized that the purpose of their life was not acquiring property. But today, don't you feel happy when you think about how much land you have? Look away and answer. When you think about how much land you have to your name, when you think about how much property you have to your name, does that not make you very happy? Back then, it was not so. Back then, you know how people made themselves happy? By thinking about how much they had given. Not how much they had acquired, but by how much they had given. That made them happy. So that was the measure of wealth back then. The more you'd given, the wealthier you were. Those days, in the times of the kings, people respected the king. Do people respect the king today? I shall ask, don't answer. People loved their king back then. Do you know why people loved their king? Because the king's job was to give. That was what the king's job was. That was the king's job. He ensured that everyone had something, enough to survive. Because there was an abundance of resources. Because there was an abundance of resources, they appointed a resource manager that they called the king. The relationship that the peasants had with the king was that. These are the resources that are available to all of us. Please would you do the honor of allocating these resources such that all of us could live comfortably. It was not politics back then. But now it's politics. Those days people loved their king. You know, reading the books and how they speak of the king Parakram Bahu. But do you think books are written today about kings of the present day in that tone, in those words? Often what you see is people coming on media and, you know, throwing out just scathing remarks about each other, completely tarnishing their image in such a way that if they lose power, they're never going to be able to come back again. Today it's a fight for power, a struggle for power. Those days, it was service. It was service because the society was not money-oriented. Society was not about what's in it for me. That was not what society was about. What's in it for me? Because people realized this sense of me is a fallacy. Therefore, their purpose in life was to somehow extract this sense of me, this sense of this perception of a self, and free themselves from that once and for all. But while they're alive and engaged in that process, of course, as human beings, we have to survive. So let's make use of natural resources, let's have a proper plan in place, and we will look after each other. That's why people back then did not serve for money. That's why you could go to the village physician and he would not look at how deep your pockets were before he started treating you. A life was a life. But today, if you can't foot the bill, they will pull the plug. Today you must be able to afford treatment, right? Now today people are scared or worried about falling ill because, not because of the illness, but because they may not be able to afford the treatments. Some people die not out of the illness, but of the fear that comes into them that they might not be able to pay the bill. So they survive the heart attack, but they don't survive the heart attack they get when they see the bill. Thank you. not even making this stuff up, honestly. But go back to the village physician. They never asked you how much you had, how much land you had, whether you had an insurance plan in place. No, because they already had an insurance plan in place. Everyone knew that there was an insurance plan in place, and that insurance plan was karma. People trusted the universe. They trusted nature. They knew that nature is all there is. That's why nothing was done in exchange for money. One of the worst things that could happen to society happened when we started using money. If there was one thing I could change, go back in time, that's what I would do. Not let society go down that route where money became the commodity and everything then began taking a value. There was a value associated to an attribute to everything. Soon enough, mother's love will have a price tag. It will. Because when everything can become, can be translated to a monetary value, now everyone starts to see the world in those terms. It's not any individual's fault. It's not your fault for thinking along these lines, because society has guided you down that track. And so when you hear the same story every day, like, no wonder anyone is influenced by that. Once again, I'm not suggesting that we go back to the olden days, put away the monetary system, and you know, we go back to exchanging things that we have. It won't work today. Because a few of us, what can we do? That will require the whole world to change its system. And this is not a system that was built overnight. And it's a system that was built over many hundreds of years now. And the powers that be will not be willing to make any changes to these systems either. But that's okay. I'm not frustrated by that. Because I'm not here for that anyway. If my purpose was to change the world, then I'd be very frustrated. It's not my purpose. My purpose is merely to find happiness within me. If I cannot find happiness within me, despite the way the world is, then I have not found happiness at all. Peace is not out there. I make peace here. So whatever method I have found to discover this peace within me, I share it with you. Again, my appeal is, let's not go and change the world out there, but change the world within you. Understand that this is what's going on. And you can start making little changes in your own lives. At home, you can start making these changes. Let's leave the conventional world where things have a monetary value and money has to be given in exchange for goods and services. Let's leave the conventional world, but understanding that that's only a mere convention. How much is a bottle of water? How much? 70? 70, right. Let's say 100 rupees for a bottle of water. So a bottle of water is 100 rupees. So water can be bought then, is it? The concept is flawed. You're telling me that a bottle of water is 100 rupees. So water can be bought, is it? Now, the mere proposition I make here sounds absurd to you, I know. You're thinking, of course water can be bought. I get my water bill every month. That's the amount of water I've consumed. The bill has it in there, in black and white. This many liters consumed, and this is the rate, and therefore this is how much I have to pay. Of course, Swami knows it. Water can be bought. No. Water is not something that can be bought. This buying is a concept in your minds. To buy something is a concept in your mind. It's a conventional concept. Things cannot be bought, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing can be sold, nothing can be bought. We're just fooling ourselves when we say, I give you this much, you give me that. That's just two minds playing tricks on each other. Actually, on oneself and on the other. So if a bottle of water can be bought, how much is the ocean? You time set by the number of liters, is it? Is that how you work out? If a bottle of water is 100 rupees, how come if you had a shop in the middle of the desert where you sold water, how come the price there is not 100? How come that's 10,000 rupees per bottle? How come? Because then you will tell me, because price is subjective. The value of something is subjective. So then it could be anything from zero up to infinity. Yeah? That proves my point. These things have no value per se like that. Therefore, they cannot be bought in the sense that you think of buying stuff. Buying and selling is merely a human conception. But we have learned to live and we have learned to understand the world in that way, that when you look around, everything has a price. The fan has a price, the ceiling has a price, these lights, they have a price. I encourage you to live your life, try and understand that these are mere conventions. Don't let that convention become your absolute reality. Once again, I'm not suggesting we discard the conventions. Keep the conventions, but please live in full awareness that this is a mere convention, not the absolute reality. It's not absolutism. People back then knew this stuff. Therefore, they didn't. Times before they had money. As I said, the farmer, once he got his crop, the first and foremost portion went to the temple. Now, if there was not a temple, in other cultures, they would take it to the kovil. They would take it to the church. They would take it to the mosque. Because that was the purpose of their lives. Whatever the purpose of their life was, the first and foremost portion of whatever they had was dedicated and devoted and committed to that. They started there. Now, I'll give you a simple example of how you apply the same principle, but not for that purpose today. Let's say that you are studying for an upcoming exam. Let's assume you're studying for an upcoming exam, right? Say you're studying for your A-levels or you have some professional exam coming up. Typically, a teacher would advise you, a good instructor would advise you, that the moment you wake up, the first few hours of the day, when you are brightest, when you are sharpest, focus that time on your studies. Yeah, that's what they would ask you to do, because you're fresh at the beginning, start of the day, bright, alert, very focused. So put that time to that, whatever it is your focus is on at that time. Because after a while, you start other things, right? And things take up your time, and then your thought cycles start to focus on various things, and soon enough you become tired and exhausted, and by that time it's no good. So you don't have your full energy. So when you're full of energy, your teacher would say, focus that energy on what you're focusing on what is important to you. So the first and foremost of whatever you have, you always put towards what is most important to you. Studies is one example. I'll give you another example. Do you remember when you were just starting your relationship? Nowadays, not. You know, now you've been living with that person for some time. But when you were first starting that, you know, just kindling that relationship, when it was just a crush, right? When it was just a, you know, you exchanged one or two smiles and exchanged numbers, right? You sent the first hello, hi, how you doing, right? So the initial message was exchanged. What was the first thing you did when you woke up in the morning? You took your phone out. Yeah? What, use it? Namo tassa bhagavato. That's what you do. That may be what you do now, but that's not what you did back then. You took your phone out to see whether there were any messages, any missed calls. Yeah, you didn't have phones. Yeah, yeah. If you had, ask your children what they do today. Ask your children what they do. If you had someone special like that, that's the first thing you would have done. Ask your children what they do. When you see your child is always checking his phone or her phone, you know that they're up to something. And you'll ask them, why are you always checking your phone these days? What's going on? No, nothing. That's what they'll say. Then you take the phone and have a look, and there you'll see what's going on. If they're not smarter than you and they delete their messages or whatever. But anyway, my point is this. When you start the day, that's the first thing you want to do. So the first and foremost part of anything you have is always devoted towards what is most important to you. Yes or no? Simple as that. Assume you're saving up for something very important to you. Maybe your wedding, a car, a house, a deposit, whatever, right? The moment your salary comes in, if you're really focused on that, you want to save your money up for a certain objective by a certain deadline, what's the first thing you're going to put the part of it towards that thing, whatever that thing is, before you spend any of it? Because you know that if you don't do it now, then your other expenses will consume your money and then you won't have any left for what is important to you. So do you see, whatever is important to you, you always devote the first and foremost part. Have I sold that point to you now? Got it? Agreement? Excellent. That is why back then people used to commit the first and foremost part of anything they had to the Mahasangha, to the Sasana. Because what is it they wanted? What is the most important thing that was there in their lives? Nibbana. That's why. The Sasana. To the church, to the mosque, to the koil, to the temple. That's where they wanted. That is what they wanted. That was the objective, that was the purpose of their existence. Therefore, whenever they got something, they budgeted the rest of it, but the first and foremost part was always devoted to what was most important to them. That's how it worked. So that's the principle behind why the first and foremost of anything. Even back, even in the king's times, when the king used to cultivate his land, the first and foremost, they used to have these, the paddy fields used to have lands, and they were in certain elevations, and the one at the top was the one that was devoted to the Sasana. And so that was where the king did his farming. The king himself got into the mud and he did the farming. And he would yield the crop. And that part was always to the Sasana. He took it to the temple himself and he offered it to the Buddha and the Mahasangha. Because that is what the king wanted for himself. He didn't want to keep kinning. He wanted to get out of that and become an arahant. But while he was the king, he did his service. That was just another mode of service. So people loved their king just as much as people love their physician. Just as much as people love their potter. Just as much as people love their farmer. So there was no discrimination in society, because it mattered not how much you had in your bank. Wealth was not measured by those terms. Wealth was measured by terms of your service to others. That's why the Mahasangha was considered to be supreme. The Buddha and the Mahasangha, because that was service personified. They did nothing for themselves. Nothing at all. The farmer had a wife. The physician had a wife. The king had his children. But the Sangha, they had none. So, when you talk about service and selfless devotion, the Sangha was supreme. Because the Buddha was their father. And the Buddha had set an example to the Sangha. And this is the way that you ought to be. So the Sangha exemplified the Buddha. Therefore, there was no discrimination like you see today. Today you are discriminated based on the car you get out of. If you drive a fancy car, you're treated well. If you drive a small car, not so fancy, you're not. Just look at when you drive into a place, into a hotel or somewhere, they will treat you based on the car you drive up there in. You know this. That's why you choose a good car. It's important to you. The way you dress, the logos that's on your shirt, all of that is important. It matters that there's a crocodile there, right? Why? Because your brand tells you how wealthy you are. Not tells you, tells others. How affluent you are. It doesn't tell how much you give. How charitable you are, how generous you are, how virtuous you are. None of those things are a sign of that. It's not one individual's fault, this. This has overcome the entire society. So once again, I'm not giving you an agenda. Let's all go change society and do that as soon as we can, or until we are all alive. We'll be dead long before society changes. So society will be like this and it will get worse. It's not going to get better. It will only get worse. But if you want hope, and that's what you're here for, there will always be those who will understand what's going on, and once they realize that this is not for me, they will leave the party. So I trust that's why you're here. You came to the party, yes. You danced, you drank, you ate, you sang. You mingled. But soon you realize, or at least now you have realized, what's this? This is not what I'm here for. I don't want to be part of this party. So now you want to depart. So this is a philosophy for those who wish to depart. That's why it says in clear words, exclusively for aspirants of Nibbana, not for those who want to stay in the party. If you want to remain in the party, these sermons are not for you. Trust you me, these sermons won't work for you if you want to remain in the party. Because I don't talk to you about how to entertain yourselves, how to enjoy yourselves. I'm teaching you how to exit. So this is a vortex. If you get sucked into this, you'll be thrown out. So tread carefully when you're walking through these doors. So I trust you're here because you want to exit the party. And, you know, like any computer that has a recycle bin, right? This is the recycle bin. These are all files and folders that got used heavily at one point or the other. You were all used, actually the better word to say is abused. Your knowledge was abused, your skills were abused, your trust was abused, your good conscience was abused, your kindness was abused. Weren't they? Oh. We can write War and Peace on that, can't we? How much you were abused. So now you're beginning to realize, what is this? This is just nonsense. This is not where I want to be. Not that you have anything against the world. It's not an animosity we have. It's simply compassion, empathy. We realize that those who abused you only did it because they knew no other way. It's not because they were vile, wicked and vicious. It's only because they are themselves ignorant. Right? So you know that it's going to keep happening to them for as long as they are stuck in their own ways. Therefore, as you try and exit the system, you want to help others if they are prepared and ready for it. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to exit the system. And whilst I'm doing that, to those who have come up to me and said, Swaminathan, please will you take us with you? I will share what I do and how I do it. But you don't see me going around giving sermons to every Tom, Dick and Harry, do you? Hey Tom, come here, I've got something to tell you. Yo Dick, come here, I've got something to tell you. I don't do that. Because this is not for everybody. Even when it's free, see how many turn up? See how few turn up? What do you have? 200 here? Even when it's free? But if you had a concert, say some celebrity comes down from India or from some other country, and he or she comes down and they have a gig, and how much is a ticket? 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 50,000, sometimes even a lakh. And the whole of Colombo is there, right? On the gold face. But where's Colombo today? Is this everyone in Colombo? There's no fault of theirs. I mean, it's just that they have not been reminded of their purpose, why they were born. So like I said, ladies and gentlemen, our ancestors knew why they were born. They knew that God had been kind to them and had gifted them a chance to free themselves from suffering. It was an opportunity. They saw human life as an opportunity, not an opportunity to earn money, become wealthy, have property, buy land and so on, but an opportunity to attain Nibbana, end suffering. To give it to you in very simple terms, all we do in samsara is suffer. That's it. If someone ever asks you, hey, what are you up to this weekend? There's one answer which if you give is always true. What's that? So I'm just suffering this weekend, man. Just say that and it's true. What are your plans for next Friday? Suffering. Yeah, you're just going to suffer next Friday. I want to make an appointment with you. Are you busy on Sunday morning? Oh, that Sunday morning, you hopefully not suffer. Hopefully not Sunday morning. Someone says, shall we make an appointment for Wednesday afternoon, say 5 o'clock? Are you busy? Yeah, I'll be suffering, man. That's what we do in samsara. Suffer, that's it. In the four great hells, you suffer. As a human being, you suffer. As a deva, you suffer. As a brahma, suffer. The level of suffering might change, but suffering is suffering. You know by this point, ladies and gentlemen, why your mind fabricates a sense of self. It's because of vexation. Vexation is another word for suffering. This is what we talked about last week. We'll do a recap again shortly. The reason your mind fabricates a sense of self is because it vexes. There's no other reason. Without vexation, there would be no sense of self. Without suffering, there would be no sense of self. Without suffering, there would be no Buddha. Why would a Buddha have to come into this world if there was no suffering? He says in no uncertain terms, you know, at one occasion he picks up a grain of sand. And he picks up a grain of sand and he says, Ananda, if there was just this much of happiness in this universe, right, one grain of sand, he says, if there was just this much happiness in the world, a Buddha would not come into this world. There isn't even this, not even a modicum of happiness in this world. That is why this world sees a Buddha from time to time. So what makes us think that we do anything other than suffering? Because all the time you are reminded of the future or about the past, and therefore you lament, you are in sorrow, or you are reminded about the future. You think, you imagine the future, and therefore you are in fear. So these two things always happen to you constantly. Even when you are asleep, you still have nightmares, you have bad dreams. Even if it's a good dream, you're still hopeful that it will turn out to be even better than it is. And you want to live in the good dream. So when is the time that you are free of suffering? Never. Then what is human life, I ask? If all we do in samsara is suffer, then what is human life? Let's redefine, let's clearly define what human life is. It's an 8-year-long lease, provided they live out your lease. Sometimes they terminate your lease mid-term. Right? These days it's about 120. It's a 120-year-long lease. To do what? To free yourself from suffering. That's it. It's nothing more, nothing less. Please try and understand that. Please, for your sake, try and understand that. That is all this is, an opportunity. To free yourself from suffering. Is that what you're doing? Is that how you spent the last 40 years? Is that how you spent the last 50? To free yourself from suffering. Wasn't much of that time spent just creating even more suffering, because you always jump from the pit to the fire. When there was one problem to try and solve that, you jumped into an even bigger problem. See, loneliness, for example, was a big problem in your life. Loneliness. You don't like to be lonely. You like to feel that you have someone who cares about you and spend time with people who you think love you, take care of you, have affection towards you. So, because you didn't like loneliness, what did you do? You brought people who you thought were like that. Actually, you know what you really did? You brought people who themselves felt lonely. How could that be the answer? You must have figured, I mean, you know, you didn't, but you should have figured that they didn't have the solution to that, right? Here's the best way to figure out whether you should marry someone. When you ask them, "I would like to take your hand in marriage," if they say yes, don't marry that person. No, honestly, that's a simple test. If you go and ask someone, "Will you marry me?" and if they say yes, don't marry them. Because they also want someone's company. So they have a box with a box with a void, and they've just found a candidate to fill that void with. They just want that box to be filled with someone. You have volunteered. Today it's you, tomorrow it'll be someone else. So if you want to find treatment for your condition, your disease, find someone who's cured themselves first. So you must only take someone's hand in marriage if they have no interest in getting married to you. Or not just you, but anyone for that matter. Find someone who doesn't want to get married and marry them. Oops. Just realized what I just said. Worship me from there today, okay? Don't come up here. some things I think after I say it. The most suitable candidate to get married to is a Rahatan Mahanse, because they want nothing from you. As long as they want something from you, they will only be with you until you provide them. The day you stop providing them, then they will find someone else who provides them. It's like having a cow. Right? If you want milk from the cow, I'm sorry for using the cow as an example. When you love, you make me laugh, right? So if you wanted milk and you had a cow at home, right? For as long as the cow keeps producing, lactating, you will keep the cow. Once the cow stops, what are you going to do? You will give it away. You'll buy a new one. Yeah, that's what you do. You know. So if you have a cow at home today, I mean a cow, you'll only keep that cow until she produces. Then if you want a donkey to carry your load for you, your burden, that you will only keep that donkey until he carries your burden. So the day comes that the donkey is too old to do that, or too weak to do that, what do? Ladies? You buy a new one. So in most houses they have a cow and a donkey. You know this is true, that's why you find this funny. You know this is true. You know this is true, but you do it nonetheless because you see no alternative. That's why. I'm here to show you that alternative. That it doesn't have to be like that. There is an alternative. And, you know, don't resent those who come to you looking for you to give them something, because they don't know any other way of going about life. You know, if a man comes to you and says, "Can I have some milk, please?" That's because he thinks that the only thing he can have is milk and there's no other way. Excuse me. But anyway, going back to where we started this conversation. So you can see society has evolved into something very different to what it was back then. It is morphed and warped into something it is almost indistinguishable from... No, what I'm trying to say is it's very different to what it was back then. It's so vastly different, sometimes it feels like civilization happened, then it stopped and started again. This civilization, this style, this format of civilization is worlds apart from the civilization that was those years ago. I'm talking about a century or two ago. Even then people had money, but if you really go back all the way to before people had money, people knew that their interactions were with the universe, with nature. Therefore it didn't matter. Like I said, the potter, his skill, he wanted to give to the entire universe, to the entire village at least. So whenever he would make something, he would always go and give some to the teacher, he would give some to the village physician, he would give some to the farmer. It didn't matter that there was something to be exchanged. That exchange needn't happen between each other because the exchange was done with the universe. It was not this way, it was this way. Their deal was with God. Their deal was with the universe. So pleasing God was what they did. There was no need to please each other. So you say God, I say Vipaka. That's how it worked. So then if you go back to where we started this conversation, why do we invite the devas? Why is it today that people think you have to please the gods by giving them something, of making offerings to them? Sometimes they sacrifice animals. In some cultures, in some traditions, I don't know whether it's now come to our country as well. So some people believe gods like to see blood. Gods like to see bloodshed. So an animal being hurt. So if the entire universe is God's creation, then I have to question, I don't expect an answer, but I have to question, why would God like pain? Why would he encourage that? Pain, hurt, harm. I don't want answers, I just have questions. Each one to their own. But if you have seen people living amongst you who are very divine in their nature, generous, kind, soft-hearted, very giving, very charitable, do you think you can please them by offering them a sacrifice? Think of someone you know like that. By their very nature, they're very gentle, they're very soft, they're very kind and very compassionate. Yeah? They always want to help. Whatever they have, they will give. Even if they don't have, they'll somehow go find it and make it available to you, even if they don't have it for themselves. Think of one person like that. Maybe it's your mother, a father, maybe a friend, maybe a teacher, right? Someone you respect, someone you adore in society. Think of just one person like that. Now I ask you a question. Do you think you can please them by offering them a sacrifice? Do you think you can please them by offering them money? Do you think they do that for money? If so, then you're thinking of the wrong person. That's not the kind of person I just spoke about. Chances are this, you go and offer some money to them and they say what? Hey, please, don't insult me. This is not for money. I do it out of compassion. I do it because I want to help you. You look like you needed help, so that's the only reason. I keep your money. I don't want your money. And even if you still insist on the money, they will take the money and they will go and give it to someone else who needs it more. Who needs it more than you. That's what they would do with it. They don't need the praise. They don't need the honor. They don't need the credit for it. They will just do service. These are the makings of gods. These are the human beings who live in and amongst you who are doing godly things. This is divinity in action. Sankara always precedes the consequence or the fruition of it. Action always precedes. Therefore, the action will always come first and the result comes next. Therefore, when you have a person, a human being, who acts in their act, they are divine. In their intention, they are divine. In their conduct, they are divine. Then they will be born divine. So this is how the gods are formed. This is how the gods are made. You make them. Where? Within you. So all those gods up there or wherever they are, up there, wherever they are, doesn't matter where they are, wherever the gods are, they were human beings who lived amongst us. They were at one point human. But their conduct was divine. So what about the animals that you see around you? Who were they? They were also humans who lived amongst us. But why are the animals and the others divine? Because their conduct was on the opposite end of the spectrum. So your cat at home was a human being once. He was human, she was human once. but their actions were feline, not divine. As a result, when they died, they were born proportionate to the karma that they had done. So then in this room, we will have future gods, deities, cats and dogs. Hope not. So the least that you should be is a human being. No lower than that. That is my ask of you. Others you will go around barking, and other dogs will come and ask you, what are you barking about? Well, I used to go to these Sunday sermons, you will say. And this is where I ended up. Don't do that. The least you should be is a human. And the best you can be is not to be anyone. That's the best you can be. But the least you should be is human. Don't aim for any lower than that. So aim for no one, you will at least end up being a human. Aim for no one. Aim for the stars, as they say, and you shall end up on the moon. So similarly, aim for no one, you will end up being one of you, a human. And another opportunity, another chance to become a no one again. Therefore, when you divest this opportunity that you have, the time, the energy, whatever you have, your health, your wealth, your youth, when you divest all these things in the various enterprises and adventures and endeavors that you have, please think very carefully about what you do with what you have. This is a chance you have. This is an opportunity. Every divestment you make is a divestment. Every investment you make is an investment. Once it's done, it's done. You can't get that back to reinvest. You have to wait for another chance. This stuff, back then, people knew about. Therefore, they did not need to exchange things for money, because they knew the moment they gave much or little, the moment they gave, because they gave with a full heart, right? They had already made a huge deposit in their karma. The deposit had been made. That's how your ancestors were always a very prosperous bunch of people. Sri Lanka was synonymous with prosperity. You know this. We earned ourselves the name Sri because of our prosperity, because we were prosperous in nature. We are synonymous with abundance, although today we have to import everything. Today we are importing our coconuts. Can you believe that? We import our coconuts. We import our grains. But this was the granary of the East. Not many years ago, just a few decades ago, we were the granary of the East. Today we import our rice. What happened to our abundance? What happened to our prosperity? Dare I say, it's not Sri anymore. This is what's happened. Because we forgot that our connection was with the universe. The moment you distance yourself with the Mahasangha, we lose who we are. We are a nation, we are a people who had technology that surpassed by eons certain technologies that are available today. Today people marvel at the technology that was used back then, and they wonder, how was that ever even possible? Scientists today are still baffling at some of those things that they see. Still today people don't know how Sigiri works and how irrigation was done back then and how the stupas and the statues were constructed with no advanced machinery like they have today. How was all that possible? Because people received from the universe the gifts that they needed. There were people who were born with these talents. They had it in them. And what did they do with what they had in them? They gave. Not for gold, not for silver, not for copper, not for cash. No. Just because they could. You know, that is why we must give. Because we can. Give because you can. Don't ask what's in it for me. I encourage you. If you are truly Dharmishta Rajagiriyans, this is what it means to be Dharmishta. Give because you can. Without asking what's in it for me. What do I get out of it? Give because there's a need. Not asking, what do I get out of it? If you give because you can, that is what registers in your karmic strand. Whenever you ask, once you give, what's in it for me, that is what registers. See, when you give something because you can, what is your attitude? Your attitude is one of abundance, isn't it? I have, I can. I have so I can. That is an attitude of abundance. But the moment you soil that, right, with what's in it for me, is that something that one would say if they have an attitude of abundance? Or is that something that someone would say if they had an attitude of deficiency? That's the kind of question you would ask if you felt a sense of deficiency, right? What's in it for me? Because I need something I don't have, so what is in it? What's in it for me? When you ask that question in your mind, it doesn't have to be spelled out verbally. In your mind, if you have that sort of attitude when you give something, it registers in your karmic strand that here is void, here is a lack, here is a deficiency. And then when it comes back to you as vipaka, it also comes with deficiency. What you throw up is always what comes back down. Throw deficiency, deficiency comes back down. Throw abundance, abundance comes back down. That's how this stuff works. It's almost magical, isn't it? Do you see how much power is vested in your ability to think? Do you see that your intention is practically everything there is? Doesn't this knowledge empower you to choose your future, to choose how you want to be, to choose where you want to be? Because people knew this, they didn't go slave at the devas and the gods' feet. That's why it's an invitation, not a begging. It's an invitation. It's an invitation between two equals. You know, it's not like we go to the devas, ane sir, ennaku sir. It's not that. Samanta chakravalesu is an invitation. We are about to preach the Buddha's teachings. If you wish, you can come. This is not a begging. Ane, come please. It's not that. We have what you want. If you want, come and get it. Because what they want is the same as what we want. To free ourselves from suffering. The only path to suffering is the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path. Therefore, if there is someone amongst us who has that knowledge, that wisdom, then a moment before we share it, we invite anyone and everyone who can just about be here and get it. So if they come in the form of a deva, if they come in the form of a god or a demigod, it doesn't matter. Come and get it if you want it. Because it's free, it's given charitably, with generousness, with generosity. So please come and get if you want. No, please actually come and get it if you want it. If you don't want, don't come. This is who we were. I don't know what is it that's come to us that we feel that we have to go and beg at the God's feet and go and please them somehow by making sacrifices and give them rotting trays of fruit and money. I mean, this is just bribery on another level. Actually, you know, if I were a God, I would kick you out of the thing. How dare you bring this trash into my chamber? That's what I would say if I were a God. Your fruits I don't eat. Your money I don't use here, because here everything I get because of my own merit. So I don't need your money for that. But here's what I would say if you came to the Devali that I was the God in and made a request. You say, Devi Anuhansa, please can you do this for me? I say, okay, can you do something for me? Right? Can you please me by being divine in your character? Go and help people. It's what I did. It's what I did to get here. You go do that now. Let me see how good a person you are. Whether you are deserving of my help. That's what I would say if I were a God. If you came up to me and asked me, please, can you do something for me? Can you, I don't say, can you bless my land? You've got a paddy field. Can you bless my paddy field and protect it from the elements? I say, okay, let me consider. Can you be a good man? Can you be a good person? Can you promise me that whatever you get out of this, you will give to others? That you won't think that this is yours and yours alone. That this is given to you from the universe for everyone's good, for everyone's use. Will you promise me that? In other words, this is not a deal I'm striking with you. I'm reminding you that you've got to be of the understanding that you have to be divine to be deserving of divine. The first thing I would ask you is, do you respect and look after your parents? That's what I would ask you first. Are you already grateful for what you've been given? Then if you don't, Amma is in a nursing home, Tata is, I don't know, my sister looks after because it's too much trouble. I was like, get out. Come back once you've started treating your parents well. That's what I would say as a God. Then I'd ask you, show me what you have already. Show me your net worth, whatever it is you have with you. How much wealth have you got? You say, I've got this much. How much land you got? I've got this much. Right, so what have you? How much of this have you given to others? Well, I'm considering giving it. Well, you consider first and do it and then come back and ask me. That's what I would say. Because I have already given and you're just hoarding it for yourself and not giving it to anyone. Why should I give you more? Why should I give you more? If you haven't put to use what I have already given you, why should I give you more? I shared this in yesterday's sermon. Were you there yesterday's sermon? Yeah? You were there? So I said, here's my philosophy for giving. Right? And soon after I said it, or just before I said it, I said, this is not suggesting that you must not give to those who are needy. Okay? I'm not suggesting that you must not give to those who are needy. Do that, but here's what I think. My philosophy is you give to those who have. Because those who have the habit of giving. That is how they have. Because they give, they have. And the more they give, the more they have. So if I have something that I want to give to as many people as possible, I'd better give it to someone who has, right? Because they give. Whereas if you give something to someone who doesn't have, they only don't have because they don't give. Remember, it's not the quantity. It's never the quantity. It's never the quantity. A grain of sand you can give. A bit of water you can give. Half a slice of the slice you get to eat you can give. That's not the quantity. You don't have to give a whole loaf. Give half a slice. Give the edges, what do you call the vatiya? Edge, right? Borders. Huh? Edges. Crust, yes. Give the crust. Give it to the birds. Give it to the animals. But give. That you can give. There's no one on this planet who's so poor they have nothing to give. Everyone is rich enough to have something to give. Everyone. Every one of you is rich enough to have something to give. It is not the quantity. So that's why I said yesterday in the talk, my philosophy is, this is only my philosophy, you don't have to subscribe to this, but this is just the way I look at it. If I have something, I shall give it to those who have. Because I understand that the reason they have is because they have a tendency to give. And I said, you might think that I am bad. What a terrible monk he is. He's prescribing giving to those who have and not to those who don't have. No, I don't say not to give to those who don't have. I encourage giving to those who have. And I said, if you think that I am the bad sadhu, think about how the universe works. Think about how the universe works. How many poor people have you seen every day, you know, under the Rajagiri, what do you call it, flyover? Right? There are plenty of poor people. They're poor every day. Then there are many people who have nothing to eat, nowhere to sleep, no shelter, nothing to wear. Right? Many poor people. It's not that I have no sympathy towards them. But in their attitude, they are poor. Because they have a poor attitude, no matter what you give them, all they'll do is consume it. Because all they do is consume it, they will never start the giving process or the receiving process. So if you can give something to someone who's poor in their attitude, don't just give the material thing. Try and encourage them to start giving. That is a greater gift than the object itself. Because then they become self-sufficient. Now once again I repeat this. If someone comes up to you, knocks on the window or something, Mahatya, money please. And if it's in your nature to give something, do give, okay? I'm not prescribing that you shouldn't. Please. That is not what I want. If there is someone who's deserving of something, may they have it. But I'm just sharing with you my philosophy. I'd much rather give to those who give than to those who don't give. And I used this analogy yesterday, so I'll share it with you as well. Imagine there's a man or a woman who has a necklace, a very beautiful one at that. A very beautiful necklace, right? But she doesn't wear this. She doesn't wear this, why? She doesn't wear this because when she wears it and goes out, others see it and they're happy when they see it. You know, they appreciate the beauty of the necklace. They say, oh, it's very nice. Looks lovely on you. And it puts a smile on their face. Just imagine this woman, she doesn't like to see other people happy. Just imagine that. This woman, she doesn't like to see other people happy. She doesn't like making other people happy or seeing other people happy. What is the one thing she would not do? She would not wear that necklace, would she? She would just leave it at home. Because if she wears it and goes outside, then others would see it and they would be happy upon seeing it. And she doesn't like other people being happy, so therefore she won't wear it. Then there's another woman. She likes other people being happy. So what does she do? If she has a necklace, she wears it with pride. She hardly gets to see it. But it's not the beauty of the necklace that makes her happy. What makes her happy is seeing other people happy. Because she doesn't get to see the necklace once you put it on your neck, around your neck. So what does she do? She wears it nonetheless. And she goes out into people and sees the smiles on other people's faces and how happy they are to see this. For that, she wears the necklace. So these are the two people. I have a question now to you. If you had a necklace, to whom would you give it? It was an opportunity for you to give a gift. You have a necklace, right? Who would you give this gift to? The lady who? Wears it. Why? Well, the other one wouldn't wear it at all anyway. Because why would she not wear it? Because when others see it, they are going to be happy. And she doesn't like other people being happy, so she's not going to wear it. Why would you give a necklace to someone who doesn't wear it? You wouldn't do that. You would give it to the person who wears it, but she wears it because when she goes out with it, others see her and they're happy. So do you see, you like to give to someone who makes other people happy. You like to give something to someone who makes use of it. Of course, the first lady that I spoke of can wear the necklace and stand in front of the mirror and look at herself for a while. But the moment she has to go outside, she will take it off and put it in the drawer. Right? I mean, only she gets happiness out of it. When she sees the necklace on her neck, only she gets happiness out of it. Whereas the other lady, she's happy to make as many people happy as possible. Once again, I ask you, who would you give the necklace that you have to? The first one or the second one? The second one. My principle is the same. That's why when I have something, I like to give it to those who give. Because that way I can give to many. This is called the can and have attitude. Or the have and can attitude. In Sinhalese it's that. Happy hacky. The opposite is? Nati barriers. This atihaki attitude is a very important attitude. We must all instill that. Ati is to have. Haki is can. I have, so I can. This is the attitude of abundance that registers in the karmic strand. Not the quantity. Not the quantity. It's not how much you have. It's the fact that you have. You see the difference? If you ask a poor man, do you have? He'll always say, no, mate. Nothing, no. I have nothing. Therefore, they will always be poor. Because they don't have, they can't give. That is that ati and haki. Haki is the ability to give. Ati is to have, to be in possession. Nati bari. Nati is to not have. Bari can't give. See, one feeds the other, right? Because bari, you're always nati. Because nati, you're always bari. So, nati bari. It's a cyclical process. There's a name for it. When it feeds itself, what's it? A vicious cycle, yes, thank you. It's a vicious cycle. Now look at the atihaki attitude. The have, so I can. What do? Because they can give, they give whatever they have. Right? The moment they give, then the more they have. To what? To give. The more they give, the more they have, the more they have, the more they give, the more they give, the more they have, the more they have, the more they give. That's a nice song, isn't it? The more they have, the more they give. So come on, rap along with me, huh? Adopt that mantra in your life. Be an individual with an attitude of have so I can. Always. Doesn't matter how much it is. Quantity is not the problem here. Never think about quantity. Leave that to nature. Nature will figure out the quantity by which you must have something. That's nature's decision, not yours. That's a very important lesson actually. I have to thank you. I don't know where this stuff is coming from, but thank you. Let nature decide the quantity. Let nature determine quantity. You determine what you're going to do with what has been given. That's your choice. Nature's choices? Is that a brand? Nature's choice. Nature's choice is quantity. Your choice is intention. So don't ever come up with this excuse. Don't have. That's an accusation to nature. That's like saying, nature, you haven't given me, so how can I give? Nature says, I've given you, you don't give. Why should I give? So teach your children, Buddha, always be atihaki. I have so I can. Never be natibari. Don't let your children adopt that attitude. If your child says, I only have one pencil, how can I give one pencil? I only have one pencil, how can I give one to my brother? You say, well, Buddha, you know, your brother doesn't have a pencil. He can't, because he doesn't. You can, because you have, so give it. But then I won't have one. But you have the ability to give. Make use of that. It's not about having the pencil, it's about having the ability to give. That is the ability. Like I said, you know, people those days, they didn't measure wealth in terms of their possessions. They measured wealth in terms of ability to give. So even if you have one of something, that's one more than those who have none. Isn't it? So if you have one of something, can't you give one of something? Then give one of something. But you say, but now I end up with none of something. Don't worry about that. The universe will worry about that. Let the universe look after that. Because it is now registered that you are someone who gives everything you have. You have given your sesata. That is what it means. Your everything. I have given my everything. Become someone, that is the attitude of abundance. I emphasize these points this much to you because abundance is an attitude that you must adopt. That attitude is registered in the universe. It is what is registered in your karmic strand, not the quantity, the attitude of abundance. Therefore, there are people who have little but have an attitude of abundance. They won't have little for long. They will have much very soon. That's how the stuff works. That's how the universe works. And that is why, back in those days, the village physician didn't charge money for service. Because they were always at the hacky. He had skill. He had the herbs that grew in his garden. And he used that. He used whatever he had. Because he was ati, therefore he was hacky. So he gave. Whatever he didn't have, he said, I'm sorry, I don't have that, but I can give you whatever it is I have. Until I have, I will serve. When I don't have, then I'm sorry, I can't do anything more. But until I have, I shall serve. Because if you don't have, it means the universe has decided that, that's enough. Let the universe decide that. Let not your attitude change as a result of what you have or haven't got. Your attitude must remain constant. Right? Your attitude must remain constant. The quantity, let the universe determine that. Some days you will have, some days you won't. But on both these days, what kind of attitude must you have? I give. So the attitude of atihaki never vanishes. Nothing to do with quantity. So this is what I would demand of you. If you came to my divine chamber and offered whatever it is you said, fruits or money, as I said, I don't want any of this stuff. I have no use for any of this stuff. Bring to me a divine character. Right? Bring to me someone like me and I will help. If you want divine support, become divine. Or be above that. When you are above that, you can then summon them. The gods will come to you. You don't have to go to them. The gods will come to you and plead to you to make use of them. Trust me. When you want a job, what do? You go to those who can offer you one and plead to them, right? You apply and say, can I have a job, please? If you can become someone who has what the gods want, it's not ambrosia. They have enough of that. I know you don't have any of that. But if you have something that the gods want, remember, four great hells, humans, devas, brahmas, we are all in samsara, therefore we all, what are you going to be doing next Wednesday? Suffer, yes. So we all suffer. Therefore, gods themselves are looking for a way to free themselves from suffering. If you have the panacea to suffering, won't the gods come to your feet? That's why they say the Venerable Sariputta Thera's feet, to him, the gods' heads were a carpet, a rug on which he wiped his feet. It is an analogy that is given. Because he had something even the gods wanted. Then they will come to you. Don't have to go begging to them. That's why Samantha Chakravalesu Atra Gacchantu Devata. This is not a beg. This is not an appeal. This is a mere invitation. You want this? Come on. It's time. Come and get it if you want it. This is the sea Helenus within each and every one of us. We were never a people who went begging. Yes, I go begging with my arms bowed. You call it begging, but actually, this is merit on two legs. I'm giving more than I get. I'm always giving more than I get. Some give me a handful, some give me a mouthful, some give me a spoonful, some give me a bowlful. But even if you could fill my bowl up entirely yourself, the entire bowl, all by yourself, I'm still giving you more than what you have given me. That is the opportunity to make use of your human life by earning merits. Merit is not in the food. Merit is in intention. If I as a monk felt that I am Natiberi, then I would come to you begging, Anay Mahatya. In fact, you know, I wouldn't even come because it would embarrass me. I would think to myself, you know, I used to be a man like this, I used to be a very successful man, I used to have servants and maids to do my things for me. I had to have a butler who would get me my food for me. How come I go to people now and beg at them? I shouldn't be doing that. How embarrassing that would be. That would be the Natiberi attitude. But because there's the Atihaki attitude, I have the gift of Pindapatha, which I am able to offer to people. I have the gift of an alms bowl. I have the gift of a robe. I have the gift of monkhood, which I can take to people and offer to them the opportunity to offer something in the hope and determination that such merits might help them to attain Nibbana. See, that is the Atihaki attitude. I want for all of you to have that attitude, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry one bit about how much you have and how much you don't have. It's irrelevant. Completely. Forget about that. Forget about how much you have. Concern yourselves about how much you have here. It's not how much you have here. Don't worry about that. I used this quote yesterday, one I quite often have said here. Some people are so poor, all they have is money. I've said this to you before, right? Some people are so poor, all they have is money. And I explained yesterday why that happens and how that happens. This happens when you steal from the universe. When you steal something from the universe and make it your own, the universe steals from you in retaliation. The universe steals from you your happiness. It steals from you your peace of mind. It steals from you freedom and just leaves you with a bit of money. That's what happens. That's a hefty price to pay. Let me explain to you what I mean by when you steal from the universe. Permit me to use the same example I did yesterday. There's a girl. She's very kind. She's very amiable. She's very nice. A nice girl. She smiles with everyone in the nicest possible way. Very gracious. And, you know, she's... everyone loves her. She's very kind. Then there's a boy who one day sees this girl, and now he wants to have her for himself. Yeah? You can play this picture out in your mind, right? How come? Gents, how come you can play this out in your mind? It's called a replay, isn't it? So what does the boy do? He walks up to the girl, and he says, I want to have you for, what's the word? What's that yuck word? Yeah, you're very used to saying it, so why not say it out loud? That yucky word, was it? For myself, indeed. Yes, so I want to have you for myself. So then he takes her for himself. From that day on, all those things that she used to give to everyone, such as the beautiful smile, the soft words, the tenderness and the gentleness. Do you think he is going to be happy with her giving it to just about everyone like she used to? No, from there on there's going to be some restrictions. Smiles only with me. Laughs certainly only with me. Let's say that she was very, you know, she was a very kind of an outgoing person, not in a bad way, in a very nice way. So, you know, she would give hugs to people, you know, just in a, to show affection, right? But now this boy has taken this girl. Is she allowed to give hugs anymore? Yes, but only to him. She's allowed to give hugs, but only to him. So she used to hold hands. It didn't matter to her whether it was a boy or a girl. Right? Because it didn't bother her. Right? But now, is she allowed to hold hands with boys? No. Now only hand holding can only be done with this boy. Right? So she used to listen to others. When they had problems, she would sit down and talk, listen to other people's problems and, you know, lend a ear, so to speak. Right? And just placate them when they have problems. But now that is not permitted. She can only listen to his problems. So when there would be people who were very sad, very sorrowful, right? What she would do is she would say, "Anne, it's okay. Come on, put your head on my lap," and then she would stroke their head until they, you know, they felt comfortable. Can she do that anymore? If she did, that would be the end of that. So that is, she can, but only with one individual. Now, won't you agree with me that he has now stolen something from the universe? Something that belongs to the entire universe. Those smiles, those laughs, those kind words, that generosity, that softness, that gentleness, that tenderness. Something that belonged to the entire universe, just like the sun, the stars, the moons, the planets, the water, the ground below our feet. Just as all of these belong to the entire universe, Doesn't her smile also belong to the universe? What about her gentleness, her kindness? All of that belongs to the universe. But what has this boy just done now? Restricted her from giving any of that to anyone else. Now it's mine and for me alone. This is called theft. In universal language, this is called theft. The moment you steal from the universe steals from you. All this while, this boy had no fear, sorrow, grief, worry, or anything for that matter about this girl. But from here on, he must live in constant fear, because his restrictions might be violated. Others might still want to get that affection from her. So if anyone comes up too close to her, what does he do? He might have a conversation with someone else on this side, but his eyes are on the other side. Sorry, got distracted. What were you saying? Hey, you, why are you stepping so close to her? Now, no peace of mind. All of that is stolen. Who stole that? The universe did. Why? Tit for tat now. He stole from the universe. Now the universe steals from him and left him with just a girl. You see, all he has now is a girl. What has been stolen from him? Everything that that girl used to give to the entire universe. Joy, smiles, laughter, happiness. Hasn't that been stolen from him? He has a girl, but that's all he has. Everything else has been stolen. The very things he stole from the universe has been stolen from him. Do you see that? See, I'm playing out things you have lived in your life, but now helping you look at it from another angle. That's why this is theft. So when your children come of age, you know, when they're in their 20s, early 20s, mid 20s, what do parents encourage them to do? Grand theft, right? Your parents encourage their children to thieve. Steal from the universe. The same could be said about the other way. There's a boy who's very helpful, very handy, is very supportive, very helpful in his society, right? Goes around and helps people. He's a good Samaritan. He's always there, out there, you know, always want to be helpful. No matter who it is, he will go and support, whether it's elderly, young, doesn't matter. But now there's a girl who looks at him and goes, oh, he's a nice boy. He's very helpful. I know, he's all given. That's what girls are like. See, when a girl, like, I've seen, like, sometimes a boy carries a baby, right, and, you know, coos the baby or just cuddles the baby. There's a girl in the background thinking, oh, how cute, how sweet he is, I wish he was mine. So, you know, here's a boy who's happy to give his love and affection to everyone, no discrimination. But there's a girl in the background thinking, oh, I wish he could be mine. So what does she do then? Somehow she conspires against the universe, right, to take that boy for, what's that ugly word again? Herself. In her words, myself. So this is theft from the universe. Because all this while, the universe had put this being onto this earth to give that strength, courage, love, affection, gentle protection to everyone. To everyone. This is one of God's creations, one of God's agents. This is an angel, really. Every human being is an angel. But when this girl takes that boy for herself, now she deprives the universe of everything this boy used to give to everyone. And then what does the universe do in return for that? It steals from her the very things that she stole from the universe. Because he used to be a source of love, a source of protection, a source of joy, a source of strength to the people around him in society. He was very helpful. But now the girl took him for herself. Therefore, she just has a boy. But the joy of having one, all of that is gone. Because from the day that she takes him for herself, now she has to live in fear and worry that someone might take him back. These are the punishments that the universe inflicts on you. See, this boy cannot be taken. This boy cannot be taken now. Therefore, what does this boy do? What this man does now, he serves the entire universe. I'm no one's pet. I'm no one's slave. I'm no one's master. I'm just serving the universe. Therefore, I cannot belong to any one of you. Therefore, I belong to every one of you. To all of you. If you dare take me for yourself, what would happen? Just think of that. Now, just a monk. Forget me for a second. A monk. Right? Assume there's a monk. A monk who's trying to do what he's supposed to do. Serve everyone. Right? Give the Dhamma. Be kind, be generous, and be, you know, very supportive to people who come and deal with him. But then there's a girl in the background who thinks, I want to have this monk for myself. She doesn't see the fact that this is a monk. That she wants him to take, she wants to take him. So she will slowly do this, what they call siusatamaya. Is there an English word for that? What is it? Huh? The 64 what? What? Charms, thank you. Yes, the 64 charms that women apparently have. I've not seen all 64 of them for some reason, but I haven't lived in society long enough for that. So apparently she shows these 64 charms and somehow convinces this monk to disrobe. And then takes his man for herself. This is theft on another level, on a grand level. Because you have just stolen something that belongs to the entire universe, to mankind, to divine kind, to humans, devas, brahmas. You have just stolen something that belongs to all of them, all of existence, all sentient beings. If you steal something of great value like that from the universe will come back and bite you. It will steal from you everything but the man. It will let you keep the man, but it will steal everything else from you. The universe will dishonor you. It will discredit you. It will shame you. Because people start making stories up. Look what this woman did to that Swami Nuhansi. He was a virtuous monk. Is this what she did? People won't see the fact that, you know, the monk equally wanted to be part of the relationship. You know, they won't look at that side. Because now the monk is a good one. The woman is the one who snatched him from the sasana. On another day, people will say, see this monk, how unvirtuous he was. You know, this woman, she only just came as a lay devotee and he has started some relationship with him, with her, and then he disrobed and see what, is this the kind of thing that he should have done? So others will look at it from that angle. Either way, this is theft. And as punishment for this theft, you will have to bear the consequences, because the universe will always steal from you whatever you steal from it. This is why I say, always give because you can. without asking yourself, what's in it for me? Give because you can. Give because you have. Because you have, you always have. There's always something you have. Have you heard of the story of the Ekasataka Bamuna? This is the Mahakasapa Thera before he became Mahakasapa Thera, before his last life, lives before that. He was called the Ekasataka Bamuna. Ekasataka meaning only one robe. Only one robe. He only had one robe. Not just him, he and his wife. They both had just one robe, so therefore the both of them could not step outside. They could not go out together because there was only one robe to cover their upper body. Therefore, either the man had to go out or the woman had to go out. One of them always had to stay back. So one fine day they got to hear that the Buddha of the time had come into their village to preach the Dhamma. So they had to take turns to go listen to the teachings. They couldn't go together. So on one occasion, as this man, now he's out, he's listening to the teaching. Excuse me. So he must have heard a sermon of this sort, to give without expecting anything in return. Give because you have. So he heard this sermon and he realized, well, all the only thing I have is my robe. I have nothing else, but this I have, it's one more than none. Right? It's one more than none, so I can offer this, can't I, to the Buddha? So he thought to himself, if I offer this, then how can my wife, my lady, come and listen to the talk? If I give this, then I've got nothing, we've got nothing more. So he came back home home that day, not making the offering. He hesitated. He went back another time. The following day he went to listen to the sermon. Similar sort of sermon. Again he was encouraged, he was inspired to give. But then again, as he was taking it off, he was hesitated again. If I give this, how can we have nothing more? So he hesitated and went home again. Another day he came and started listening to the sermon. Through the sermon he realized, you know what, today I must do this somehow. So during the sermon, he made a resolution, made a resolve. The only thing he had, his only worldly possession. And remember, if he gives this, his wife is not going to be able to come out again. But what he did was, he took it off, folded it neatly, and offered it at the Buddha's feet. And he proclaimed with great sense of joy. He said, I have won it. I have won it. So he couldn't contain his joy at the ability to be able to give. Because he thought to himself, I have, so I can. It's not I don't have, I have, I still have one, but it's more than none. So he gave it. And then there were some of the king's men there, and the message went up to the king. There were some spies. The king's spies took the message up to the king. And the king got to know that there was a man who was in the audience who had proclaimed that he had won. So the king got scared now. The king thought that there must be some coup somewhere in the country. And now they were making plans, conspiring against the king. Right? So then he summoned this man to the royal court. So this innocent man, he was taken to the court by the king's guards. And the king asked him, is it true that you said you made a cry of victory? That you had won? This man says, yes, sire, I did. Okay, what is it that you have won? Are you conspiring against me? He said, oh no, sire, it's not that. And he repeated the story. On the first day I went, I listened to this talk and I wanted to give, but the only thing I had was what we both had. So if I had given that robe, then I would have nothing left to step outside with. Therefore, I hesitated. It happened the second time, had it in the third time. But on the last time, I decided I had to give it somehow or the other. So I gave it in the end. And that, to me, was a great personal victory. That is why I cried out a great paean of joy. And that is what your gods must have heard, sire. And the king was very pleased to hear this story. You know what the king did? In return for this offering that this man had made, the king said, What a great man this man is. He is a king. He is a true king. He has won himself. He had so little, yet he gave up his everything. And then the king gave him enough and more robes for both him and his wife. And each time he was offered robes, he took all of it back and offered it to the Buddha again. So he was given two robes initially, one for him and one for his wife. Both of them he offered to the Buddha again. Then the king summoned him again and gave him four robes. All four of them he gave to the Buddha again. And then the king summoned him again and gave him eight robes. All eight of them he offered to the Buddha again, the Buddha and the Mahasangha. So, but then he realized at a point, so if I keep doing this, it's not very nice, because it looks like I'm forcing the king to give something up when this may not be what he wants to do. So ultimately he decided that he was going to keep one for him and his wife, and the rest he offered to the Buddha. But, you know, it's a real example setter. How many times might we have plenty, but yet we hesitate? Because we think we don't have enough. Because we are worried about our tomorrow. If I give this today, what will I have for tomorrow? If you believe in nature, if you believe in the universe, ladies and gentlemen, if you believe in the principle of what you give is what you get, you need not worry about tomorrow. Because tomorrow will look after itself. Give today, so you need not worry about tomorrow. Don't keep today for tomorrow. Give today for tomorrow. 180 degrees apart, these two principles, aren't they? Most people do what? They keep today for tomorrow. That's not the principle that you must have. Give today to get tomorrow. That is how it works. You are all so blessed, and you have what you have today, less or more. Whatever it is you have today are one's intentions to give. It was never the quantity. This is all an intention to give. So what I see before me are intentions, good intentions. I always tell our people at the monastery, whenever I go out to Colombo and I see these big houses and big cars and, you know, luxury, sometimes these grand hotels sometimes, you know, when we go past these places and I see how people live in luxury, in my heart I always rejoice in that. I'm very happy for that, because I know that it's not what I see that makes me happy. It's what I know that makes me happy. I know that what they have today is a result of what they have done in the past. That I know. How much giving must they have done? How much charity must they have engaged in to have received this today? Isn't that something to rejoice in? How much atihaki must they have had in their attitudes? To have more today, they must have given a lot. Isn't that something to rejoice in? Therefore, I don't subscribe to individuals who look at people who have in abundance, who are affluent, and, you know, in their hearts and minds, you know, it's derision and scorn, and they're jealous, and they say, oh, you know, these people, you know, they've got blood money, and drugs money, and bribes, and corruption. Corruption today may be, but you don't get anything for corruption. You don't get the money you have with you because you were bribed or because of corruption. This is because of what you've done in the past, the good that you've done in the past. Perhaps because you bribe today or you accept a bribe today, maybe if you're corrupt today, you will have to suffer tomorrow. But the present is always the consequences or the rewards of yesterday, not an action you did today. Today's actions will bear fruit tomorrow. So choose wisely today for a better tomorrow. If your today is good, it's because your yesterday was good. You chose wisely yesterday. I was going to talk to you about what I spoke about last week, do a recap, and I promised you I would as well, but now there's not enough time for that. But, you know, this is the fertile ground which is essential for stuff like what we talked about last week to make sense. These seeds are very potent. The Dhamma, Anicca Dukkha Anatta, these seeds are very potent. They're very fertile as well. But the ground has to be fertile at the same time. There would be no point in throwing these potent seeds on hard rock. They would not take root. Not suggesting for one moment that that is what you are. But part of my job, our job together, is to do both these things, both ping and kusal. Kusal is when I talk to you the Dhamma, pure core Dhamma, that is kusal time. Ping is when we talk about these attitudes, these virtues, cultivate these things within ourselves, have the right philosophies. That foundation is absolutely essential, ladies and gentlemen. Don't for a moment ignore that. Please don't think that you should just learn the Dhamma and that's the be-all and end-all of it. The Dhamma will not have any effect on you if you don't have the right attitudes within you. It won't. You need to have that fertile ground. And that also happens through the sermons, the association that you have. So these things have to go hand in hand. Which is great because I like the way that these sermons progress. You know, one week we talk the pure Dhamma, sometimes we go into very deep concepts of the Dhamma, and the next week we talk about something entirely unrelated to that, but it's actually helping you to progress yourself on the softer side. And let's be honest, right? You know, in this audience, which is a mixed bunch, there will be some who are very strong in their wisdom. That will be their strongest faculty. There will be others whose Shraddha is the stronger faculty. There will be others whose Virya is the stronger faculty. There will be others whose Samadhi is the stronger faculty. There will be some who are only taking baby steps in the Dhamma. So for them, maybe this kind of thinking, this Sudhugati business is very new to them. Because, you know, new faces appear every day. But this mix, I think, it works beautifully for us. So never be disheartened that today's sermon was not about the Dhamma or today's sermon was only about the Dhamma. No, leave that to nature. Let nature decide that. You bring two things, merit and attention. You bring those two things and leave the rest to nature. I leave all of that to nature myself. I don't come. See, today I thought I was going to come and talk to you. Ask the Anagarika Mahatma. I said, today, he asked me, what shall I leave on the desk? I said, no, nothing is necessary because I'm going to do a recap on last week's sermon. In fact, I promised one or two people of you yesterday, last week when you came up to me, I will do a recap of your last week's sermon. There you go. I'm one big fat liar. So please forgive me. My intention is not to, you know, just throw random stuff at you. It's not that. My intention is to guide you gently. Gently. Sometimes we row, other times we just let the boat glide. Because we need to rest from time to time as well. Now, last week's sermon was quite heavy, as you know. So it's not that we don't have the Dhamma. The Dhamma is there. But we have to give it in the right doses. If I teach you everything I know today, you won't come back next week. You won't come back ever. Trust me, you won't. Because some of it will make sense. About 10% will make sense, but the remainder will not make sense. A few of you will make sense, about 50 or 60% of it, but the remaining 40% will not make sense. That is not because you are poor in any way or lacking in any way. It's just because this is the way the journey works. Can you walk on just one foot and tie the other foot behind you? That would be a very short walk, wouldn't it? You'd trip and fall and you would hurt both legs. But we have been gifted with two legs because you can put one first and then the other one and the other and the other and the other and the other. And it's a very comfortable walk. You can go very far that way. So we have a long journey to go, not a fast journey to go. So we need not rush, Let's take our time. Said the same man who a few moments ago said that life is very short, and you have to be very heedful. What I mean by that is not use this life to study as much Dhamma as possible. That's not what I mean. Living life to the fullest is what's important. Live deep, not long. You can't decide the length of your life, but you can decide the depth of your life. Can't you? So decide the depth of your life. The length of your life? Who decides that? Nature. What's nature's to decide? Let nature choose. What's yours to decide? You choose. These are videos of two of our tours by a few of our monks. One tour is a tour from Italy. So there was a recently two of our monks went to Italy. And the same, and the Maitrihandru, so the two monks that went to Italy were Mahindahandru and Bakkulahandru. You've also heard from Maitrihandru, our German Swami Nuhanse, and him and his student, who's also from Germany. So they went to Germany and Poland recently. And I have a short video of these tours. I want to show these videos to you, ladies and gentlemen, because I want you to rejoice in the good work that is done in the name of the Sasana. That is why we make an effort to produce these videos and bring them here and show it to you. This is not us showing what we do to you. It's not that. This is us together in this. I want you to identify your contribution here and rejoice in that. They were anagarikas at one point. Before becoming anagarikas, they were just lay individuals. Some of them may have come and been around you, influenced by your support and your compassion, your demeanor, you know, just a gentle demeanor that you have. All of that encouraged them to take this step forward. Then they became anagarikas. Once they became anagarikas, you were there all the way, providing them with the four requisites. And then they went to become monks. You were there when they were ordained. You were there to wish them well and wish them a successful monastic life. You were there for that. You offered them Pindapatha. Right? So this is all a culmination of all that. Therefore, I want you all to be part and parcel of this. Embrace the journey that we are all making together. Okay? And enjoy this to your heart's content. That is what this video is for. One step at a time. We take the Dhamma across oceans and continents. And one heart at a time. We heal aching hearts and broken minds. It's important to be part of this journey for yourself, most importantly, and then for others along the way. Guru Handra never lets us do service to others without serving ourselves first, because he doesn't believe that that is possible. I think that is true. The Buddha had to become the Buddha first before he could help others out of samsara, right? Therefore, the same goes to you as well, ladies and gentlemen. It's tremendously wonderful that you bring people here from time to time, introduce others to the Dhamma. I'm sure you share links with others. This is all part of that, and it's all possible because of what you do for the Sasana. But remember, the Sasana happens within you. So make sure that that takes your priority, your salvation. See, you saw that in the captions, many of those sermons were titled "The Value of a Human Life, The Value of a Human Mind." Manasahitaka Vatnakam. How it's a human mind that can do what you're doing right now. To find purpose. This is an opportunity. Never ever forget that. This is an opportunity to free ourselves from suffering once and for all. Please don't forget that. Please never let anyone convince you that this is an opportunity to acquire wealth, to gain glory, fame, education, start a family, grow an empire, whatever. This is not any of those things. This is just an opportunity to free ourselves from suffering. Whilst we work on that, let's do a bit for our sustenance. Let's make sure we have meals to feed ourselves. Let's make sure we have a roof above our heads. Let's make sure that we have clothes to keep us warm and keep us safe. Right? That's fine. But I suggest that that is where you draw your line. Because the more you divest your internal resources to other things, the less they will remain you left for your own salvation. I have the same number of hours per day as you. You ask yourself whether you're doing what I am doing as hard as I am and as fast as I am, as diligently as I am, to achieve the same goal with the same amount of time. It almost feels unfair. Surely you must be given twice as long to live than I, right? Because you have twice as many things to do. That should be the way it is. You must be given twice as long to live. For me, 60 years, you should be given 120. You are given 120. If I am given 120, you should be given 240. Why? To do all these things, look after your children, you know, build your property and acquire wealth and get all your education certificates and do all that. Have your grandchildren and then see their grandchildren, or at least their children, right? And then once you're done with everything, 120 is done, then another 120 to attain Nibbana. That would be fair, wouldn't it? But alas, this is what it is. Nature has decided quantity. You should decide how you choose to live it. I pray for you. I make my adhisthana for you. I will do all that and I will work myself to the bone to help you to get across this ocean of samsara. But I can only do what I can do. The rest is yours. Long live the Sambuddha Sasana. Let's transfer our merits and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Mahasaya to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path. First and foremost, let us transfer this merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to the Mahanayaka Theras, the Anunayaka Theras of all of the chapters, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin and have committed themselves to prosper and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana for ages and years to come. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us transfer this message to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend your well wishes. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us transfer these merits to the gods and divine beings, including the Sakadeva, as well as the deities who have constantly got a watchful eye over you and keep you out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives. I beg your pardon. Let us transfer this message to your loved ones who have passed away in your name, your ancestors, your forefathers, reminding ourselves that it is in the blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in the natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics. And reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will all have been someone to us, either a mother or a father, brother or sister, friend of some sort. Therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness, let us transfer all these merits to all. If any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may these merits help them to be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's made this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahataran in Mahanse in this life itself or in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you. Raga ginnen midatnva dvesha ginnen midatnva moha ginnen midatnva nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayam Sukhita Taravatma Mamadasya Loka Siyalu Satvayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Raga Giniveva Dvesha Giniveva Moha Giniveva Nivansata Labe Nivansata labheva Nivansata labheva Tunvange suvisi ananta mahaguna belin Sīla loka sīla sattyona Nibbana paramasukhen sukhita tarvetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu